This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 11th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 109th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We've done it again. You're about to take a cultural journey around the world from the comfort of your headphones, your living room, your commute. Let us be your guide to the globe's cultural calendar. First up, we'll be hearing what got execs excited at this year's InTV conference in Jerusalem.
It's a very interesting market that I think is particularly why people are looking at it. There's a lot of people making a lot of shows.
There's a bit of an art theme this week too. We'll be meeting Diane Brown, who's been working hard to get contemporary art into American hospitals for over a decade, and will soak up the stars and sails to international fairs celebrating their 20th birthdays, Artissima in Turin and Art Taipei. And we'll meet Australia's comic book genius, a man who they've made documentaries about, a champion of the weird and wonderful to be found on home soil.
There seems to be a growing acceptance of the graphic novel as a valid literary and or artistic expression. I've noticed I've now been invited to attend the Perth Writers Festival.
Plus, if that weren't enough, Americana stalwart Slade Cleese will be here to tell us why Texas isn't as bad as you think, and play us a few tunes from his new record as well. That's all coming up here in the next 53 minutes on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So we kick off this week with our Midori House session, and this week we turn to Slade Cleese, whose website probably says it all. Grew up in Maine, lives in Texas, writes songs, travels around, tries to be good. For all that, he was born and raised in America's Northeast. Slade Cleese is something of an archetype of his adopted Austin, a wry literary writer who's quietly assembled a sprawling catalogue of eloquent Americana. He came to Midori House recently to share its latest edition with us, a new album called Still Fighting the War. From it, this is the title track, Still Fighting the War.
Hard times coming home now, can't get your feet on the ground. Got some issues and no one wants you around. Barely sleeping and you can't get through to the VA on the phone. No one's hiring and no one wants to give you a loan. And everyone else is carrying on just like they've always done before. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war. Flashback to Fallujah, lost another best friend. Three tours of duty and you're wondering when it's all gonna end. Body's broken and bone shattered. Blood and dust in your mouth. Getting weary, but you're running with the few and the proud. Sometimes you wonder why you went. You don't wonder what you stayed on for. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war. Men go off to war for 100 reasons, but they all come home with the same demons. Some you can keep at bay for a while, some will pin you to the floor. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war. The bedspread is frayed, faded and tearing apart. Two strangers holding each other in the dark. Tell me, what were you dreaming? How did you think it would end? How many heroes are scattered out into the wind? And all the happily ever afters turn to broken dishes and slamming doors. You've been home for a couple of years.
That
now,
was Slade Cleese with Still Fighting the War. And of course, he'll be back with more a little later on. Before we see what the art world has been up to over the last week, we're crossing first to the land of TV. Executives and industry leaders from around the world gathered in Jerusalem last week for the second annual InTV conference. It's an international event organised by the country's Keshet Media Group, the brains behind Prisoners of War, a hugely successful show which was remade for an American audience under the new title Homeland. The two-day event featured speakers from across the industry and is designed to keep up with the latest innovations in this rapidly evolving world. But it's also a chance to showcase Israel's TV and media community, and it perhaps comes as no surprise that many of the guests attending are on the lookout for the new homeland. So our pal Peter White, senior international reporter for broadcast, was there, and he stopped by Midori House to speak to culture producer Katie about this year's event.
Israeli TV is extremely hot right now, coming off the back of Homeland in particular. So they wanted to sort of leverage that, and they managed to persuade a lot of extremely important TV people like Bob Greenblatt, who's the head of NBC in the US, and a number of UK execs to go over and sort of figure out what the next shows are that will travel. And people were always talking to the producers and seeing what might be the next Homeland. Yeah, it was an extremely interesting event, and in Jerusalem, a place that you don't necessarily think of in terms of television. So it was a wonderful setting for this place as well.
And as you say, Israel is kind of hot in television right now, and they're a small country that punches above their weight in terms of the content that they produce. Why do you think they've been so successful at making good shows that have done well internationally?
It's a small country, as you say. There's about 8 million people who live in Israel, and there's only a couple of TV channels. But if you look at some of the shows that have come out of Israel, whether it's In Treatment or Homeland or Hostages, they've managed to create really exciting and really interesting formats. But if you look at them, they're all really quite cheap to produce. So the Israeli producers you talk to say they have to come up with stories that are slightly more interesting and slightly easier to film than perhaps just doing a show with a big car chase or an explosion. So you get these really exciting stories that come through the shows. And when you meet the Israelis, they're always saying they're storytellers. And it really does come through in some of the television that they make that, you know, perhaps countries of similar size have never managed to do.
The first show that you flagged is called Yellow Peppers. I was just left slightly confused by what it's about.
It's had a few titles. The direct translation of the Hebrew is Yellow Peppers, and apparently that's what the couple in the show grow. But in the UK, it's being called the A Word, which it probably makes a little bit more sense. It's a family drama about this extremely talented kid, an extremely talented musician, but the parents find out that he's autistic, and it's how they deal with it. It's a really good show. It's been made really well in it. So yeah, it's coming over here. Channel 4 is developing at the moment in an English language version. The thing about this show is that it's quite funny, and while it deals with these sensitive subjects, it was created by a woman called Karen Margalit, whose child is autistic. But the thing is, it's not a wallowing show, it's not about despair. It's basically just a sort of quite a funny, uplifting drama about the family and how they cope with it. It's not sad at all.
So tell me about some of these other shows that are being touted as the potential next Homeland.
Yeah, so there's a few more sort of action-based shows that are a little bit more like Homeland. The big one that a lot of people are talking about that they haven't really announced yet is a show called The Dig. In fact, being written by Gideon Raff, who is the creator of Prisoners of War, Homeland. And he's writing it with a guy called Tim Kring, who created Heroes a few years ago and Touch with Kiefer Sutherland. And in fact, Tim was out in TV to talk about the project and talk about his sort of general involvement in this world. And it's a mystery drama, and it's actually being filmed in Jerusalem, or they're looking to film it in Jerusalem. And there's not that many more details known about it, but it's the type of thing that you can see matching the sort of experience of someone like Tim Kring, who created Heroes, with the guy who created Homeland. Is just a fantastic proposal. So that's one. That's what a lot of people were talking about. There's another one called Mice, which in Israel is known as the Godan cell. That's a bit more of a traditional spy drama. So that's one that a few people are certainly looking at. In fact, NBC is developing at the moment, and we might see that next year on screens in the States. Okay.
And I'm wondering how the process works when, say, an American network or an American broadcaster wants to remake a programme that is Israeli. Do they then work with the writers of the original series to translate it? Or what's the kind of involvement of then of the Israeli networks or TV companies beyond that point?
I'm sure it depends who you talk to. But I think when these US companies and in the UK take these ideas and these formats from around the world, they're not really necessarily just buying the idea, because the ideas on paper are pretty easy to replicate on the whole. What they're really trying to buy is the soul of the show. So they generally do work with the creators of this. And Mice is a perfect example. They're taking the writer out there into the States, and they're developing it for a year or so, which is a little bit longer than the usual process, because they want to get it right. Because the thing is about these shows, as I said, they have something a little bit special to them. So I don't think it's just a case of Americanizing them. They really want to try and get the soul. And I think that's why certainly the first season of Homeland was such a success. It felt a little bit like there was something more to it.
So let's move on, because it's not just dramas that people were looking at while they were in TV. Comedy is something that's coming through a bit as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's not something you'd necessarily hear about, Israeli comedy, but there were two in particular that really caught my eye in TV. There was one called She's With Me, which is this story of an Israeli supermodel who decides that this sort of local baker, this guy who's never travelled outside of Israel, will become her boyfriend and travel with her around the world. And it's a really sort of fish out of water story. And that was really, really quite interesting to watch. And I think a few people sort of caught that and thought that might be something that we can see around the world.
And what are the odds that she will fit into his family?
It's funny. I mean, yeah. It is funny. And it's also, it's like a trailer for a rom-com film.
Exactly. It's a rom-com with a slightly bit more heart, or certainly a little bit more to it than perhaps your sort of average Jennifer Aniston rom.
And just finally, we've got to talk about Rising Star. This is a reality TV format, which is coming out of Israel at the moment. Having watched part of it, I'm slightly confused as to how it differentiates from other reality TV wannabe pop star formats, but maybe you can just explain what the show is.
There have been lots of talk in the last few weeks and months, and particularly at MIPCOM, which is the last time I came in to talk to you, lots of people talking about Rising Star. And it sounded on paper very much like Idols or X Factor. And they took us to a taping of it just outside of Jerusalem. And it was, you know, you walk into the big studio where there's the guy, the good-looking guy in the nice shirt singing a traditional pop song, and your girl belting out a big sort of Whitney Houston number. But there's this element of technology to it whereby all of the viewers are putting this in through an app on their phones and deciding which one of the two contestants is going to go through. And when you're watching it on this big screen, the numbers are flashing up, so you can actually see in real time who the public likes, and the performer can see who the public likes as well, maybe, but you know, helping them to improve or try and do something to get their, help their situation.
I think situation. It could be a little distracting.
But, perhaps, exactly. But there was two in particular. There was, as I said, there was, you know, your traditional stock boy band type members, but there was a collection of guys called the Amazing Rabbis, two, you know, traditional Jewish men dressed in traditional garb, and they were belting out Simon Garfunkel numbers and a version of Hotel California, which is something definitely you have to see to believe. On a dark desert highway, cool wind in
my hair, one smell of colitas. That was Peter White talking to producer Katie there about the InTV conference in Jerusalem. For those just joining us, you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where it's time now to get a taste of what the art world has been up to in recent days. Last week marked the return of Art Taipei, now in its 20th year, and one of the big three art fairs across Asia. While shows such as Art Basel Hong Kong may have stolen the spotlight in recent times, the slow and steady evolution of Art Taipei over the past two decades has coincided with a consistent growth in demand for top artworks from collectors attending the event. With sales turnover expecting to reach over $40 million this year, Art Taipei has quietly become the hub of a new hungry art market in Asia. Reporter Chris Fitch took a tour of the galleries at this year's event.
An ear-pounding drum show may be a dramatic opening to an art fair, but that's just how they do it here at Art Taipei, which prides itself upon being the biggest Asian-organised art fair in Asia. 2013 has seen another record-breaking year for attendance, as several big-name galleries have chosen this 20th anniversary of the fair to appear for the first time.
We feel that Taiwan has a high potential for Western art as well as for Asian art. There are some good collectors we know here. Taiwan has a long-standing tradition of collecting art, especially Western art, that is quite unique in the whole region. Maybe the most developed society if it comes to the fine arts.
Andreas Hecker, director of the Hong Kong Gallery of London's Ben Brown Fine Arts, who have included work by Damien Hirst, desiccated butterflies preserved in formaldehyde, amongst their offerings. This is their first time exhibiting at Art Taipei, and Andreas is feeling positive about this more relaxed style of art fair.
I think it's more of a local fair. It's not too big. As a visitor, you come here, you walk over the fair, and at the end you don't feel overfed with art. If you go to Basel in summer, you need 3 days for the main fair and another 2 days for some fairs around, and then you have to see all the museums. And I like these local events that are very focused, and I like the fact that there is so much different art to see here from the region. It's Asian art, it's Western art, but predominantly still, I think it's still an Asian art fair.
Of course, it's the opportunity to sell which is drawing these galleries to Art Taipei. Another new international entrant this year is Silverlands from the Philippines. Nelly Goh is director of the Silverlands Singapore space.
Lately, we have been hearing about the art market here in Taipei. That's why it made us very interested to join this year. One of our artists had a show here and the reception was very good. The audience here, they are more open to different kind of art.
In agreement with this are some more first timers. From New York, Lehman Mappin. Jessica Krebs is Associate Sales Director.
It's a very established collector base here. The collectors here are very adventurous. Their tastes kind of lie a very wide spectrum of work, not necessarily just Asian artists, but Western artists as well.
The Lehman Mappin exhibition includes some classic avant-garde neon exhibits by Tracy Emin, as well as work by artists from a little closer to Taiwan.
I think we wanted to really bring a very good mix of Asian and non-Asian artists to the fair, and also represent our artists that we've worked with for a long time. Like you've mentioned, Tracy Emin, we've represented her for over 10 years. So it was very important for us to establish that we represent her and that she's a very important international artist. We also chose to bring Lee Bull and Do Ho Sa, two of the best known working Korean artists today. We just had a show with Lee Bull in March. It was our inaugural exhibition at the space, and we're opening a show next week of Do Ho Sa's work. So again, very important for us to kind of summarize our program in a sense and what we plan to do in terms of our exhibitions in the coming months.
Despite these new faces at the fair, there is still a strong domestic presence. Some galleries have participated since the beginning 20 years ago and have seen the huge changes take place firsthand.
It's changed a lot, and honestly, this year it's actually the most international fair ever comparing to the past editions. There's 150 galleries, and then a lot of them are from abroad, and then mostly still focusing in Asia, but comparing to the past, it's more of a domestic fair.
Shelley Wu is from Taipei-based Tina Keng Gallery and TKG+. She accepts that the fair is being increasingly attended by more international collectors, but insists that their core target audience remains much more domestic.
In the past, yes, it's mainly Taiwanese collectors, but we are opening up. And then we think that in the past 2-3 years, we have seen that gradually more and more, but still mainly Asian collectors.
Jessica from the Liang Gallery, also based in Taipei, describes how entrants such as themselves bring not just a large presence of Taiwanese artists, but young artists too.
We are the gallery that really focuses on Taiwanese artists. There are many different galleries here who focus more on the Chinese artist. So we really want to let the younger Taiwanese artists to have a chance to present their work.
There's a feel-good factor about the whole event, and all the galleries remain optimistic about the prospects for growth in the Taipei art market. The issue for Taiwan is whether the rest of the country can grow to catch up with the sums of money changing hands at Art Taipei.
In terms of Asia, it's not a major player. Taiwan doesn't at least in the top 15 countries in terms of importers is not on the scale or in terms of exports of art. So it's in terms of its wealth and its importance in the economy, it's got a lot of catching up to do in the art market, to be perfectly frank.
James Goodwin is an international art market expert and lecturer. He believes that the Taiwanese art market can become a leader in the region, but that people at Art Taipei shouldn't let themselves get too carried away quite yet.
The potential is there. It's a question of marketing. The tax regime is very important for the art market. Museums, where art can be compared to, a general interest in culture amongst people from a young age. Any number of factors can be involved, but really the potential is there for sure, because Taiwan has the money, to put it crudely. It's just a question of whether there's the impetus to follow through on a cultural basis.
The numbers don't lie, but ask anyone at Art Taipei whether there is such an impetus in Taiwan, and the response will be overwhelmingly positive. This art fair is in every way mixing traditional with contemporary, Western with Asian. Doing an art fair their way and putting on quite a show. For Monocle in Taipei, I'm Chris Fitch.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. More art next, but this time we're headed to the north of Italy.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're staying on the topic of art, but this time crossing to Italy, a country that's sadly now often characterised as a place in economic decline, with a near constant political crisis and an art market depressed and a little stagnant. Well, that's the usual news story anyway. Despite all this, last week saw the opening of Italy's largest art fair, Artissima, or Very Art, which, like Art Taipei, is also now in its 20th year. It might not be as big as its Swiss Floridian or London art fair rivals, but Artissima has acquired a reputation for excelling in one very important field of contemporary art, curation. They say Italians love to show off, and in Turin, some of the world's most celebrated artists and curators have been doing plenty of flaunting, as David Pleasant found out when he went to meet some of them. That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to Italian art collector and philanthropist Patrizia Standretto Re Rabadengo at the Artissima Art Fair in Turin. Still to come in part two, more music and some wisdom from Slade Cleeves. We'll meet the Australian comic book publisher who's championing the nation's homegrown industry, and we'll find out how former nurse Diane Brown has managed to get world-class art into medical institutions across the US. Don't go anywhere. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So we return first to this week's Midori House session, and those who might regard Texan music as exclusively the province of hooting, hollering good old boys with an unmistakable red tinge around their collars should perhaps pause to recall that Austin exists. The Texan capital has a long tradition of kinder, gentler, more liberal interpretation of country music, an isolated kingdom eternally ruled by Willie Nelson. It's from this world that this week's guest, Slade Cleeves, emerges, and he sat down to tell Andrew Muller all about it. To get us in the mood, here he is first with Welding Burns.
My father was a welder down at the Navy Yard, up on the North Atlantic where the winters come down hard. A union job, some overtime, nobody would complain. He went to work with humble pride through the snow and rain. Some things you're born to, some things you gotta learn. My father built his world on bone, muscle and blood, and welding burns. After work there was some drinking, it'd get a little rough, just to knock the edges off, but he never got enough. He'd hang his coat up by the door and light a cigarette. Mama'd take his supper out and turn off the TV set. Some things you're born to, some things you gotta learn. My father built his world on bone, muscle and blood, and welding burns. I can see him down at Lee's Mills Pond with the August sun warming her brown skin. He promised he'd take her away, but I think he knew even way back then, way back then. Said they're hiring, no need to graduate. Maybe your dad could make a call to the 788. I always thought I'd get away, I thought I would rise above. I don't remember anymore.
Slate, the first song you played there was the title track of your new album, which does discuss fairly explicitly a PTSD-struck Iraq veteran. It was kind of a subject you addressed on a song called Hard to Believe on Everything You Love Will Be Taken Away, or at least you referred to it. It struck me that in the last 10 years, this has been kind of a subject that American music, and especially American country music, has taken sort of a pass on. Why do you think it's been so little addressed in song?
I don't know. And it's the kind of story that just tugs at my heart. And it's a story that's both in the moment now. You read stories about vets coming home and having a hard time. And yet it's an age-old story, too. I mean, of course, it happened with Vietnam vets and it happened with World War II vets. You know, it's an age-old thing that we're just seeing the latest iteration of. And that's sort of like the perfect subject for folk music, really.
you're narrating from, you know, a fairly extreme experience which you haven't experienced yourself. How much nerve and I guess how much research do you find it takes to do that?
Well, I was very careful and very cautious is the word, I guess, because I don't want to get it wrong, you know? I don't want to pretend that I'm a veteran. I'm not. I don't have any close relatives who are veterans. But I have a friend who passed away recently, was a Vietnam War vet, and I have a cousin in the military that I talked to recently. Most of my research was done sort of friends of friends, but also on the internet, just reading articles. The thing that really got the emotional core of the song was I came across some photographs that were Pulitzer Prize-winning photographs. A photographer named Craig Walker did a study of a one particular post-war situation, one vet suffering from post-traumatic stress. This amazing, harrowing series of photographs of a vet going through all the stages of suicide attempts and breakups with his girlfriend and being denied housing and being denied a job and on the phone with the VA. It's really harrowing.
There is one character I did want to ask more about who appears on the album and does appear by name. This is God's Own Yodeler.
Man, you know, I grew up in Maine and my wife Karen and I moved to Austin about 20 years ago just to sort of soak up that famous Austin music scene and to build my career there. And one of our first nights there, we wandered into a free show at this little smoky roadhouse with pickled pig's feet on the bar, and this huge rotund man stepped up to the microphone with a bunch of his buddies playing steel guitar and bass and fiddle and drums, and he started to sing in this sort of Roy Orbison meets Pavarotti kind of operatic, beautiful high voice, and then broke into these amazing, faster-than-your-brain-can-comprehend yodels. And that was Don Walzer, who was just this fascinating, one-of-a-kind musical personality in Austin that I became friends with.
You mentioned there Austin, Texas, which is your adopted homeland, or hometown rather, and your adopted home state features prominently in another song on the album, which did make me laugh while I was listening to it repeatedly, which is, of course, Texas Love Song, which is kind of a backhanded hymn to your adopted home state. I want to ask, first of all, why you picked on Texas, but also that particular song. Was it just one of those things where the appeal of trying to find as many rhymes for Texas as you possibly could was what kept you going through it?
Yeah, that was one factor. But also the context is that, you know, Texans are just inordinately proud of their state. And I can see that as an outsider because I grew up in New England, 2,000 miles away. And it's just always funny to me how proud Texans are. I don't know if you've heard this story, but I've met a few people who are Texans, and that for some reason, for a job or whatever, they're called out of the state and they're having a baby, right? Their wife is having a baby. What they will do is have someone from Texas mail some soil to wherever they are so they can place the baby's feet in Texas soil as soon as he's out of the womb.
Well, some of those stereotypes maybe do still exist then, but if you're looking for a wider interpretation of Texan culture, Slade Cleave's new album, Still Fighting the War, is out now, and he's currently playing a few dates along the West Coast. SladeCleave.com is where you'll find all the info. Right now, you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Let's head now to Australia, a place full of dangerous creatures and strange, inhospitable landscapes. If that sounds like the setting of a cracking sci-fi comic, that's because it is. The Australian comic book industry is on the cusp of becoming an exciting cultural export, and many local producers are choosing to set their stories down under. Chief among them is the publishing house Gestalt. Founded in 2005, the company has grown into Australia's largest purveyor of locally produced comics and graphic novels. Gestalt's founder, Wolfgang Bildsma, was recently the subject of an ABC documentary called Comic Book Heroes, in which he adamantly refused the need to relocate to the US to break into the comic industry. Monocle's Adrian Craddock met Wolfgang at the South Perth pub, where the company was first conceived, to ask why he still calls Australia home.
We had a launch event back in 2005 in the pub here. It was absolutely packed. We had live music playing as well and a few people who got quite merry. But I guess we'd set that up as the launch for the company. We didn't have any product. It was really a shout out for what we were trying to establish, as well as inviting people to show us what they could do. When we first started, we had this idea of being able to take Australian content to the world. And we're particularly focused on Perth content at that point in time, because those were the people that we knew. They were around us. They were part of the reason that we created the company.
How would you describe the state of the Australian comic industry?
I think the Australian comics industry doesn't yet exist. You know, there are
some disparate communities of people, passionate creative people, who will continue to produce their own work and produce work of those around them. We've had people like Milk Shadow Books come in online in the last 2 or 3 years. Silver Fox Comics have started up and they're producing their own graphic novels now as well. I'd really like to see more of these people take on, I guess, the international market, just to get more Australian content out there and to get more exposure to Australian content. In terms of within the country, there seems to be a growing acceptance of the graphic novel as a valid literary and or artistic expression. I've noticed since the documentary, for example, I've now been invited to attend the Perth Writers Festival, whereas prior to that, you know, I would be knocking at their door and I wouldn't be taken too seriously. Either that or my messages weren't getting through. I can't say.
You talk about the Australian comics industry not existing yet in some ways. Has it always been this way in Australia? I mean, is there such thing as the golden age of Australian comics?
I think there's been a golden age of Australian comics in terms of people who used to reprint American comics in Australia. Of course, with American comics being able to be imported directly into Australia, that sort of fell by the wayside. Look, we've had, you know, certainly blips on the radar with products like Platinum, Grit, Dar and Dill, you know, comics that were around in the 80s especially and into the early 90s. I think we've certainly entered a stage where there is a lot more production going on, and with production comes a lot more buzz and awareness. So the more people that are creating and the more people who are generating interest, the better the groundswell will be for finding new readers, getting new distribution.
You don't see too many comics that are actually set in Australia. I guess that's changing in a way, because when you think about it, the Australian landscape really lends itself to being comics, doesn't it?
Very much so, even to the point where Mobius set a series called Airtight Garage in Meekatharra. It's like, you know, everybody's saying, this landscape is so foreign. It's like, I know, that's Australia.
Yeah, there are people thinking it's outer space or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, seriously, there's that sort of barren, desolate wasteland, but it's got such a character to it that it becomes something of a personality in and of itself in a story.
It must be tough for any independent comic publisher, whether they're in the US or even in Australia, because, I mean, it seems like, much like the Hollywood system, there are huge players at work, a massive system that's very hard to penetrate. How do you approach that?
With caution. I guess we approach the US market, where it's saturated with huge players as well as some quality independent publishers, just with the idea that we pursue great storytelling regardless. You know, we get people that come back to us year after year now saying, oh, what's new from Gestalt? Yeah, they're not necessarily saying, what's new from Sean Tan? What's new from Christian Reed? It's like, what have you guys done? Because we trust you as a brand.
Do some people produce these comic books with the sole hope of them being picked up and turned into a franchise like many of them have been?
I know of a particular publisher in the US who operates on that basis. I believe they create the high concept and they pitch it to studios. Only once a studio expresses interest does that concept then become a comic at all.
Are comic books at threat because of that, or graphic novels at threat because of that? Because of that process, are they almost seen as a stepping stone to, you know, silver screen success?
Yeah, I think that process does undermine the validity of the medium, and it certainly, I guess, threatens the idea of expanding on an existing audience somewhat. I don't think the medium itself is, you know, at risk of disappearing because of it. I think the fact is that it's the greatest storytelling medium in the world, and regardless of any number of these people seeking to exploit it in terms of generating, you know, huge money out of pitching it to studios and producers and what have you, there will always be the audience who respects and appreciates fine storytelling in that medium regardless. It's not at risk of disappearing, but this may damage its expansion.
That was Wolfgang Bilsma, founder of Gestalt Comic Book Publishers, talking to Adrian Craddock in a pub in Perth. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Ever wondered how you get a significant artwork into a hospital? We'll be explaining all next.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. There are few experiences more uncomfortable than being in hospital. The flickering white light and sterile walls can make even going to a doctor's appointment a little unappealing. But what if the space was colourful and quirky, full of bright hues and pleasing images? Could art be used as a healing tool? According to Diane Brown, a former nurse turned art gallerist and the brains behind RX Art, it can. RX Art is a non-profit organisation that transforms paediatric pavilions into engaging spaces decorated with site-specific works of famed contemporary artists, and it's been enlivening hospitals in the US since its launch over a decade ago. Our New York bureau chief, Santiago Tarditi, met up with Diane to find out more.
How many hospitals are you working with current, and how do you pick these hospitals?
Well, sometimes they pick us, and sometimes we pick them. We wanted to work in Los Angeles, and I wanted to work at Cedars-Sinai. It's a great hospital. They have an amazing art collection that Marcia Wiseman started. And I thought that since RX Art is all about quality, and so is Cedars-Sinai in their medicine and their art, that that was the ideal place for us to work. They have an art council, and everything is contributed. They only accept contributions of art, but they all have to be, in their words, museum quality. We don't accept any contributions of art. Although sometimes we offer artists an honorarium and then pay all expenses when they do a project for us. And sometimes a well-known artist will contribute his work without asking for the honorarium. Terry Richardson, Ryan McGinley, Jeff Koons, they all said they declined their honorarium. So at Cedars, I said I wanted to work there. We had to go through an application process with their arts council, submit the artists we wanted to work with, and the project that we wanted to do. And just 2 weeks ago, they said, we're really excited for you to do this project. So we're going to work on the ceilings of all the pediatric rooms. We haven't done a ceiling project, but it's, of course, something I've always wanted to do. Jeff Koons did a CAT scan machine for us, which was knocking out one of my passions. And now I really want to do ceilings. I mean, kids are lying on their backs in bed, not just kids, but we work only with pediatrics now. And to look up and see something that's stimulating and interesting and colorful, I think it'll be great. It's going to go across the ceiling and then down that wall that has all the instruments, the oxygen hookup, the blood pressure, and so forth, to sort of take some of the scariness away from that.
Who are the artists you're currently working with, and how do you source the artists?
Well, I've been in the art world for more than 30 years, so I know the artists. I keep current, and I have a lot of friends who are artists and dealers. We have a board of people who are knowledgeable. We work with Company Agenda, who's very knowledgeable. And artists will suggest their friends or their colleagues. But we're working with Dan Colon right now, who's a great friend of RX Art. He's going to do an enormous project in the entire pediatric ambulatory unit of Kings County Hospital. We're going to do a confetti wallpaper over 5,000 square feet. We're going to do the ceiling tiles printed in confetti, the baseboards, and we hope the upholstery. It's going to be awesome. We just finished a project with Kenny Scharf, and the doctors in psych had been saying, please, can't you do something with this stairwell? It's so bleak, and it was really bleak. And the kids go up and down it several times a day, going to class or to the gym. So he said, please, you know, fix this up for us. And Kenny seemed the perfect person. And these are kids that grew up in the city, and they knew Kenny's images, and they were so thrilled that this artist would do it for them. I mean, it gave them a feeling of self-worth, which these kids desperately need. It was very cool, and also joyful.
There is proof that laughter or prayer might help in the betterment of patients. Is there any proof so far that art has improved the quality of the patient's stay or in their health improvement?
There's a lot of research. And actually, the best research is being done in London at Chelsea and Westminster. There are many studies that prove that it decreases the length of stay. if the patients are in a happier mood, if the staff is happier, if it's a better healing environment. So art certainly contributes to that. As far as physiological changes, that's harder to quantify, but there is research being done, and actually we're going to be doing a study. We're working with a doctor who is a developmental neurologist.
Diane, another of the projects is a coloring book that you sell in some of the coolest boutiques around the world, but you also use in the hospitals. Tell me more about this coloring book.
The idea behind the coloring book was to distract little children. Well, children of every age, actually. And you could possibly be in pediatrics till you're 21 in some hospitals. And I can tell you from having been a teenager in a pediatric ward, it's very insulting. So I didn't want to hand a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old a coloring book. I figured they would swat the nurse. But each book has, we're on volume 4 now, it's going to be released in November, but each book has between 50 and 60 artist drawings. And we have the best artists from all over the world. It's really cool. They love doing it. And the idea was that little children would be happy to color anything, which they are, and that older kids could just look at great drawings. And we find that adults call and say, can this be used by adults? Well, of course it can. I mean, anybody can look at great drawings. This is an interesting cover. This was a cover with zebras on it that Rob Pruitt did for us. And the cover is so cool. It's these two zebras crossing each other, and it's painted in red and purple and pink. And we're making it into a dry erase room for pediatrics. It's going to be a wallpaper that'll be printed, and they can put an anti-graffiti covering on it, which makes it like a whiteboard. And the children will be able to sit in the waiting room and color in these zebras, and then they can erase it.
That was Diane Brown, founder of RX Art, talking to Santiago Tarditi. If you want to find out more, just go to rxart.net. And that's just about all we have time for this week. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, produced by Katie Bilboa and assembled by a crack team of sound engineers in the absence of our usual rock, Holly Fisher. Time for one last track to finish the show. This is Slade Cleese from his Midori House session with Broke Down. Thanks for tuning in.
Sure had a pawn shop bound of gold, a sink full of dishes and a love grown cold. Along came a boy, pretty as the devil, she took his hand, the whole thing unraveled. There's no turning round, it's broke down. Billy took the ring, jammed it in his pocket, drove downtown and tried to hawk it. Down at the bottom of Lake Pontchartrain, there's a love note carved inside a wedding ring. Broke down, cracked and shattered, left in pieces like it never even mattered. Broke down, torn in parade, ain't nothing left you could give away. There's no turning round, it's broke down. I know telling where love goes, maybe down where the Black River flows. Won't be coming back round, it's broke down. Baby in the backseat and another on the way. Sherry thinks of Billy at the end of every day. Spends her nights waiting for real life to start, listening to the sound of her double-crossed heart. Broke down, cracked and shattered, left in pieces like it never even mattered. There's no turning round, it's broke down. On the other side of town, two lovers lie still, cigarette smoking on a windowsill. There's a picture locked up in an old suitcase. Billy closes his eyes, but he still sees her face. Broke down, cracked up.